This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 17 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me today, as he always is Mike Morrison. In this episode, we'll be joined by our editor and producer, Dennis Castello, to discuss Dennis's field of study known as media ecology. We'll be discussing some of the core concepts and distinctions within media ecology as a discipline, and we'll also be discussing how those concepts and distinctions apply to and within the Star Trek universe. So, Mike, welcome to the show tonight. How are you tonight?
I'm doing well. How about yourself, Zachary?
I'm doing great. It's been a busy week, but it's always nice to sit down and record an episode of Metatrex.
Yeah, and I'm really excited to be joined by Dennis Castello, our editor and producer.
Well, we joke that Dennis is the sort of the silent member of the Metatrex team. You know, he's with us every single time we sit to record an episode of Metatrex. I see him on the screen every single time we record one of these episodes, and it's great to finally have a reason to bring Dennis on the show with us tonight.
Yeah, and I'm glad to see that, you know, he's adjusted his lighting a little bit, so he's not a disembodied head, sort of Nagilum sitting out there, as we famously joked about on the Babel conference.
Yeah, if you didn't get that reference, there was a great picture of Dennis Castello. He looked like that floating head of Nagilum in the episode of Star Trek The Next Generation. He had this great sort of black mood lighting behind him, like his head was a little disembodied. And you can find that picture floating around the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listener group. So if you didn't get the reference, go find that picture. It's quite amusing.
All joking aside, though, Zachary, it really is very fortunate for us that we're able to borrow from his talents and his abilities. This is something that that he does in the real world, as they say, and for him to bring those talents to Metatrex and to Trek FM, we're just doubly blessed.
You know, we tend to focus on philosophy proper here on Metatrex. But, you know, the original intention of Metatrex was to have a sort of broader field of study. Let's talk about psychology and sociology and some of these other disciplines besides purely philosophy proper. And one thing that I think really interesting about Star Trek fans in general, and definitely the people who are involved in Trek FM, almost everyone has some particular interest or field of study or some expertise that they have. So it's great to finally have a reason to bring Dennis on the show. When we were trying to think of a reason to bring Dennis on the show, we said, Dennis, what would you like to talk about here on Metatrex? And he said, oh, media ecology. And my gut reaction was, I have no idea what that is. So I'm really excited because I don't know anything about media ecology. It's new to me completely. I'm looking forward to seeing what connections we can make to Star Trek and what connections I can make to the things I know about in philosophy. And I'm looking forward to learning something new in the process today.
Yeah, same here. For 13 years before I began my current day job, my current career in healthcare, I actually worked in the newspaper business. And I served on editorial board and was very involved. I was on the advertising side, but you know, obviously there is a close relationship between advertising and editorial in the newspaper business. So this is something that there's a lot of interest for me, and to be able to bring Dennis in and discuss this, I'm really looking forward to it. Dennis, we want to give you an opportunity to kind of introduce the topic and share with us some of your insights. So Zachary, I think this would be a great time for us to bring Dennis on board and hear what he's got to say. Introduce the topic of media ecology and how it relates in the Star Trek universe.
Sounds great. Dennis, welcome to your first live episode here of Metatrex.
Welcome, Dennis.
Thanks, guys. It's really quite an honor to be here with you.
So Dennis, introduce us to media ecology.
All right. Well, sure. Let's see. Media ecology is something I studied as an undergrad. The theory of media ecology is a tool that sociologists use to examine human society. It's not a hard and fast law of cultural development. It's not considered that way. Rather, it's a way of thinking about human culture and trying to understand ourselves and our society. It was summed up by Marshall McLuhan's famous quote, "The medium is the message." What that means is that the predominant medium that a society uses affects how that society perceives and thinks about the world around it. In other words, although overshadowed by the content being delivered, the very method that a medium uses to deliver that content is having a subtle effect on the consumer. I'll read a quote that McLuhan wrote in 1964. "Everybody experiences far more than he understands. Yet it is experience rather than understanding that influences behavior, especially in collective matters of media and technology, where the individual is almost inevitably unaware of their effects upon him." So that was McLuhan's take, and that kind of sparked this whole study of media ecology. And the idea is not that any one person in particular is going to watch a TV show or read a newspaper article and have their behavior radically altered. The idea is that over time, an entire society's behavior will be altered by the predominant media that society consumes. Also, keep in mind that media ecology is just one ingredient in a big soup that makes up the forces that shape human societies. No one ingredient alone is responsible for the course of human events. That being said, however, some ingredients do influence a soup's flavor more than others.
See, Dennis, I find this really fascinating because it strikes me that we're living in a time when media, the types of media we have are changing more rapidly than they've changed in the past. I mean, oh, yes. You can look back at the history of mankind and you can think, you know, for hundreds or thousands of years, maybe we wrote on stone tablets or, you know, made cave paintings. And then at a certain point, we developed, you know, writing and, you know, we wrote on various types of things, but it was all fairly static and fairly, it wasn't a fast medium. And then, you know, flash forward into the 19th and 20th century, and you get new forms of communication like telegraph and radio and television. And now with the internet, within the last 20 years or so, we're experiencing a proliferation of new media types. You know, in the 19th and 20th centuries, you get, I'm thinking of things like in the 19th century, you get the telegraph and Morse code. Into the 20th century, you start getting radio and then television. And then all of a sudden, with the rise of the internet, we get a proliferation of new media types. I mean, even the mere fact that we're doing a podcast today is an example of a new media type. The fact that the new Star Trek series is going to be on an internet-only CBS All Access delivery model versus being on a traditional television model. And so it seems like the pace of this change is accelerating. Am I kind of right in thinking that? We're smack in the middle of it. I don't think we know what that will mean for us as a society or us in the future, but it's a fascinating time to be asking the question, what effect does this change in media have on us as a people and as thinkers and as a society as a whole?
Oh, yeah. I think you're absolutely right on track. Media is rapidly changing, and this is one of the reasons why people who study media ecology are drawn to the subject, is because for the first time in a long time, you can see society actually kind of being shaped as you watch it by the kinds of media that they consume. Let me give you some more background on some of the precepts of media ecology, if you don't mind. Might help us as we move forward in discussing this.
Sounds great.
One of the core concepts of media ecology is that there are different categories of mediums. Now, McLuhan used this really complex system that he called hot and cold medium. But for the purpose of this podcast, I'm going to simplify it down way, 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 way down. Hopefully not anger any academics in doing so, but I'm going to simplify it way down to its basics.
We're angry already. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know anything about this. I'm already angry. I'm already feeling self-conscious here.
Hopefully you won't get any angrier. So I'm going to simplify it down to the idea of slow medium and fast medium. So a slow medium requires more imagination or work on the part of the audience. It's more detached from emotion or slower to create an emotional response. And it reaches fewer people or it's slower to propagate ideas. Right. So think of...
reading a novel or something like that, right? Very slow. It takes me, you know, a day.
Reading a novel, exactly. Whereas you read the novel, it requires work because first you have to understand the alphabet mm-hmm. and you have to understand the language, how to read it. So that requires a lot of work right there. But then even just to consume the content, you have to kind of imagine in your mind, if it's a novel, you have to fully flesh out, what does that person look like? What do they sound like? What does their environment look like? All that kind of thing. And your brain is filling in all this stuff. You're doing so much more. And because of that, you're more detached. It doesn't create quite an instant emotional response. In some ways, it can create a stronger emotional response once the emotional response builds, but it's slower to create emotional response. And also, it reaches fewer people because, you know, in the days before the printing press, you had to hand write things out, or the printing press had to print the books. Right. You still had to give the books to people, and then they had to read them. So it was slower. Now, a fast medium is exactly the opposite. It requires less imagination or work on the part of the audience. It's more emotional. It's much quicker to generate emotional response, and it reaches more people quickly. So that would be like a movie or a TV show. That'd be a fast medium where you don't have to create so much in your mind because you're seeing it right there. You're seeing what the actor look like. You're seeing what they're wearing. You're hearing their voice. You're hearing the music. It's creating an instant emotional response, and it's broadcast to a lot of people at once.
Right.
So that's a fast medium. Before you can really categorize something, you kind of have to categorize it in relation to other things or in relation to combinations of things. So in other words, you would have the spoken word, which is a fast medium, mm-hmm. versus the written word, which is a slow medium, the printed word, which is a slow medium, versus television, which is a fast medium. And then relative to each other, you have the written word, which is slow, versus the printed word, which is faster, or the printed word, which is slow, compared to radio, which is faster, versus cinema, which is faster than radio, versus television, which is faster, versus the internet, which is even faster than that. So
it seems like these aren't sort of well-defined categories. I mean, there's no, you know, it doesn't make sense to say that one medium is just fast in and of itself. It's fast in relation to other types of media, or slower in relation to other types of media. But these aren't sort of rigid categories.
No, they're not. They are designed to kind of illustrate or help you kind of apply what the effect of a medium is on the society, especially as it's kind of displacing another medium that came before.
Well, I have a question for you right off the bat there, Dennis. One thing that comes to mind, it seems like there's a trend towards progressively faster media, and that's probably tied up with the consumers of those medias, progressively shorter attention spans. I think, you know, people don't read novels like they used to. They tend to gravitate towards movies to consume their fiction. Of course, there are exceptions. You know, Literary Treks, of course, is one of our sister shows on the Trek FM network about Star Trek novels. But, you know, I watch far more television than I actually read novels at this point. And I tend to consume my news through fast media versus slow media. And I think that's a trend in society as a whole. Is that trend purely because of the amount of work involved, or does media ecology have a different take on why that trend is happening in this day and age?
Media ecologists would probably say that it's your society that's enforcing this change, or that's causing this change,
as opposed to the individual making conscious mm-hmm. choices.
The way I would say is right now, the excitement in the Trek world isn't about the next book that's coming out, right? It's about the next movie. It's about the next TV show.
And it almost doesn't matter how brilliant of a novel is coming out. It could be the most brilliant Star Trek novel that's the most engaging, the best character development, and it's not going to be as popular as the next Star Trek movie.
That's right. And it's not necessarily you, the individual, who's doing that. It's the society that you're in causing that. The idea is it's basically out of your hands. This is something that affects a society. It's not really designed to look at an individual's actions, how it changes one individual's actions as opposed to another individual. But it's how an entire society is reacting to it. And people that are caught in that society are kind of caught in that web, and they're kind of being moved Correct. By the threads when they get pulled.
So I know that Mike probably has a question. I know we want to talk about some Star Trek mm-hmm. as it relates to media ecology, but I do have another early question for you, given everything you just said.
Sure.
It strikes me that as certain types of media are become faster and become maybe easier to consume, and maybe are reinforced societally in the type of way you just mentioned, that it also becomes easier to produce different kinds of media. We're living in an age when there's an abundance of really amazing creative tools that allow individuals or small groups or large companies even to make really high quality content very quickly, very easily, very naturally. With this trend towards faster media that are easier to consume, is there a sort of a parallel trend of tools that are easier to make content? But does Media Ecology observe that there are that there's an increase in the number of people who are making the shift from being content consumers to content creators? It strikes me that as media gets faster, it doesn't surprise me at all that more and more people gravitate towards content consumption in these faster, easier methods. I think that strikes me as really natural and easy to understand. But as it gets easier to create content, is there an increase in the number of people who are creators versus merely consumers? And or is there some brute force fact of human nature where some people are just going to naturally seek out the creative aspect of media no matter what the media of the day is? There were creative people using Morse code. There were creative people making television. Now there's creative people making podcasts, right? Is that the same group of people over time with the same personality traits or core human nature? Or is there some shift as a result of the changing media creation tools that are out there?
Well, I believe that if you look back through history, you'll see that this is essentially a cycle, right? If you go back to the earliest form of media that media ecologists recognize, that would be primary orality, the spoken word. So, and in the spoken word, it's open to anybody. Anybody who has a voice can tell a tale. Then comes the written word. Now, the written word is much slower, and it's not available to everybody because it's quite a learning curve. You must learn it. And throughout history, illiteracy was the norm. Then when the alphabet is created, it is easier to express ideas with a minimum of training. Unlike, say, ideographs or hierographs, pictograms, that kind of thing, where you kind of have to learn every single one of them. In alphabetic society, you just have to learn the simple rules, and then you're off and running, and you're able to create your own material.
It's a fairly simple set of rules.
Yeah, and it's funny how world conquest can shape how the world consumes media. We think about Alexander the Great, 323, he died in 323 BC. At that time he had conquered the known world and Hellenized the world. And so we have, our first really universal language, the Greek language. And obviously that's where we get to alpha, beta. And so really, I think then, Dennis, am I right to say that the written word probably... at least in terms of the ancient world, probably had its strongest roots.
I would agree with that, absolutely. It's also doing some other interesting things, and this is something we were going to come back, and I'll come back to this, but first I want to finish off the thought that Zachary brought up, which is after a while, you've got the printing press comes to the fore, and you pretty much to use that media, that medium, you need a printing press, and very, very few people had that. But then printing presses turn to typewriters, and a lot of people have typewriters. And then the medium of the day becomes radio or telegram, let's say telegraph. Not everybody had a telegraph. They had to go to Western Union to send a telegraph. Then comes radio. Not everybody has a radio broadcasting station. See what I mean? It goes through a cycle where technology drives media, it becomes inaccessible to the wide range of people, and then it slowly becomes more accessible. There was film, and you had to have a big film company. It was very difficult to make films. And then television came out, and suddenly every city had a television studio. So it's a cycle. To answer your question, I'd say that it's a cycle. And who knows that right now the internet puts the power of producing media in everybody's hands, but who's to know, maybe the next thing that comes out is kind of a virtual reality, holographic reality where you need a motion capture studio to produce that material. And then we're back to studios producing content and the regular Joe is left out of it.
The cycle you're describing, Dennis, sounds really interesting to me because it strikes me it's almost paradoxical. It strikes me that when any new medium is created, there's a proliferation of creativity, right? It enables new kinds of communication, new kinds of creations, new kinds of maybe new kinds of stories, new kinds of interactions, new ways of interacting with other people. But once that new medium becomes a type of norm, you know, for a while, the printing press was the norm for communication. For a while, newspapers were the norm. For a while, the telegraph was the norm for receiving news, so on and so forth, right? And with each one of those types of media, there are sort of implicit rules that and structures that are developed to reinforce that kind of creation. Like, for example, you mentioned telegraph. I'm a ham radio operator. One of my favorite things to do when I'm not podcasting is to sit down and pull out my ham radio and have a nice casual, long, what media ecology would call a slow medium conversation in Morse code. And I can do that. It's kind of a wonderfully anachronistic thing to do in this day and age compared to the new media that we have. But there are certain rules. There are ways you communicate in Morse code, certain abbreviations, certain standards, ways, communication patterns, ways in which the interactions tend to go that are different than you get in ordinary language, that are different than you get on a podcast. But those are a norm and they're fairly rigid. If you deviate from those, you're sort of outside the club and you don't know how to use the medium correctly.
Sure.
So I guess that there's a heart of a question there. To what extent does each new medium influence creativity and or constrain creativity as a result of these kind of unwritten standards and rules that are created along within a new medium? Is that even a good question for media ecology? That's a question that comes naturally to mind. But
I'm sure that it is a good question for media ecology. It's not necessarily a question that I'm like really versed in. All I can do is guess and give you my opinion on that.
You can give us your gut reaction.
My opinion is that you'll see artists come forward whenever any new media is developed, but you don't see the real bloom of creativity until that medium is dispersed into the public at large. Once you see that, then there's a real bloom throughout society. Think of photography. Mm-hmm. You had your gardeners when the photography was first invented, who shot some beautiful photographs, which are works of art to this day. Mm. But when anybody could pick up a camera and shoot snapshots of their family at the beach, then mm-hmm. the camera was more likely to get into the hands of creative people mm-hmm. who may have never taken art class in their lives, but were able to apply their innate creativity. And now you saw a bloom of photographic artistry.
And interesting to me, I think the photographs were different, right? The style of photograph that you got in the mid 1800s all the way into the early 1900s were very different than what you see in the 30s or 40s or 50s and very different from what you get when you get disposable cameras, when it's very easy for anyone to whip out a camera and take a picture of something in the moment. And that's different from what you're seeing with digital photography today. So it's not like the camera is kind of transparent, right? You sort of think on the one hand, a camera might just give you a window into what's happening in the world. And so why would there be a shift in the style sure. of photography just because because of the proliferation of the number of cameras that are out there or the ease in which to use them?
Well, now media ecology does come into play because what's happening here is that the early photographers are seeing photography for the first time. They grew up with paintings. That's how they learn their artistry. And they're applying what they know to photography. It's almost like they're trying to put a square peg in a round hole. Mm-hmm. The next generations that follow on have grown up with photography. They're used to photography. It's almost in their bones and in their blood. And so they now, mm-hmm. when they get a hold of a camera, they're coming up with completely different things. That's the effect that a medium has on society. It makes them think about things in a different way. And then you start to see that real burst of creativity.
Dennis, are you trying to tell me I podcast like I send Morse code? Wait a minute. There's a seed of a criticism in there somewhere.
That everyone is affected by the media that is around them. They're shaped by the media environment they live in. Yeah.
It's the angry. Don't worry, Dennis. It's the angry scholar coming out in him. You know, photography is an interesting one for me because, you know, we've even gone beyond, from photography, we've gone to creativity in the darkroom. I can remember taking photography as a high school student and working in the darkroom and learning techniques to actually enhance the photographs that I've taken in the darkroom. So now we've taken photography and we've advanced it into a whole different type of art form to the point now to where we can digitally enhance and manipulate photographs and do incredible things that you couldn't do with just a photograph. And it's interesting to see how that changes the way people both create and consume the media. Dennis, you mentioned something early on in your initial thoughts, and I wanted to kind of circle back around to it.
Sure.
You touched on how, media shapes a society, and that's kind of, I think, at the heart of this this study of media ecology. But I think, at least in my mind, I think what we have is a bit of a chicken and the egg sort of paradox. In that I think, at least early on, and we only have the reference of our own lifetime and our understanding of history, but at least in my lifetime, I think we've gone from the idea that art imitates life to the idea has always been that art imitates life, but I think we've gone full circle to the point now to where life actually has begun to imitate the art form. And so people are the accessibility and the ability of people to create media. I remember, working in newspaper when, we first started inviting readers to submit photographs and actually contribute to the news. And now everybody's got a cell phone, with a, megapixel, 10 megapixel camera. And,
sure.
We're snapping real time video to the point now that I almost can't flip on the news or go on the internet without seeing somebody's, camera phone video of the news event of the day. And I think it's interesting how that plays into the way we consume and create media.
All right. Well, let me go back and we're kind of drifting from media ecology. We're doing something that most students who are new to media ecology do, and that is we're confusing the content with the medium. So let's go back and talk a little bit about examples of media ecology in action.
Okay.
The best example, I think, is the difference between primary orality and alphabetic societies. So here's primary orality is a society that has no written word.
Right.
Everything is propagated. All their only medium is the spoken word. Their ideas and their stories, they're all spoken. Their songs, their stories are on the campfire. They're that kind of thing. Now,
I'm thinking of that episode of Voyager where they get stuck in this. I'm trying to remember what it is exactly. They get stuck in this alternate. There's an alternate time flow around this one planet, and the time is moving differently on Voyager than it is on this planet. And they first encounter this planet. The people there are basically telling oral histories and oral stories, but Voyager gets written into the mythology of that planet. But that's that kind of early sort of proto society is what you're getting at.
Yeah, that's the first example. So you look at that society. Now, that's that society, everything is literal, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have no abstract concepts. They have no concept of the zero. If they have a theology, it's the god of the sun, the god of the river, the god of the wind, that kind of thing. Now, an alphabet is developed. Now, the thing about an alphabet, the interesting thing about the alphabetic medium is that it is an abstract symbol that represents an idea. That idea could be a phonetic sound. Now, once a society begins to use that alphabetic language, they develop the ability to think abstractly. And now you start to see in those societies for the first time, anthropologists start to see the concept of the zero coming about. And most interestingly, this creates some controversy, but most interestingly, that's the first time you start to see societies that are monotheistic, They have a more abstract idea of a deity that is not just the god of the sun or the god of the wind. Mm-hmm. The theory of media ecology says that that alphabetic medium has shaped that society and given them the ability to think more abstractly. And then that grows and that leads to other ideas and other developments.
Yeah, abstract thinking can go viral. I mean,
indeed.
Right. Once it's out there, you can get more complex ideas and put ideas together in new ways. And that's almost self-propagating at that point.
The alphabetic medium is like the carrier of the virus, right? It creates that ability for them to think abstractly. And then now suddenly the concept of zero and other things are. So that's like the example that most media ecologists use right off the bat to demonstrate this idea of media ecology shaping society that has nothing to do with the content of the media.
So I've got my first sort of probing question I want to ask you. And, sure. and I already had this question sort of written down, but now I think I know better how to ask it, given everything you just said. One question that I had was whether media ecology is mainly descriptive or if there's a normative component to it. Descriptive in the sense of just trying to give sort of a historical, factual account of the evolution of media and how it relates to a society's thought, where there's no judgments being made, no account of the way things should be or where society should go in terms of its use of media or its the future development of media or future development of a society's thought. Is it purely descriptive or a little normative? And the sort of secondary question I have is to what extent is this account of the history of the relationship between media and thinking sort of well-known and established historically or anthropologically, and how much of this is us kind of looking back and making sense in hindsight? Because I come from a background in philosophy, and there was this tradition in modern philosophy in like the 16th, 17th, and 1800s of trying to ground your philosophy in some sort of fictional origin story. Like I'm thinking of like Thomas Hobbes and his account of the state of nature to justify his political philosophy. Like he would give an account of imagine a primitive society that doesn't have that isn't a political society that doesn't have political organizations, or it isn't a society yet, you know, a society of individuals who are struggling and fighting, where life is nasty and brutish and short. And he gives this very sort of appealing account of what life pre-society might be like, and all of that is supposed to ground his political philosophy. Now, in retrospect, you can look back and say, well, you know, we don't really think any of that is actually true. It's just a useful fiction that he's using to motivate his ideas. To what extent is media ecology really well-grounded in history and anthropology and these really factual, well-researched disciplines, and how much of this could be interpreted as an attempt to make sense of these things after the fact? How much of this is us filling in the gaps, in other words?
Well, that's going to depend on who you ask, obviously. Media ecology does have its detractors, and there is some controversy over it, usually around the concept of where it might explain religious ideas and things, as you might expect. Mm-hmm. But there are quite a number of anthropologists who accept media ecology and who use some of the precepts of media ecology in their study. In fact, one of my favorite books is called The Alphabet Effect, written by a scientist who worked with Marshall McLuhan, who's an anthropologist, and talks about the effect of alphabet on early societies, and it's really a fascinating read.
And this it strikes me that, you know, the evolution of the alphabet and its effect on a society, you know, we have so many actual examples from history that we can draw upon, you know, societies that we know things about to various degrees. It strikes me that this can't be a totally fictional story that's made up, right? This is well-grounded in actual research on the history of the evolution of language and whatnot.
Yeah. There are shelves and shelves of books on this subject.
So the last of my sort of really deep critical questions before we dive in and talk about Star Trek. I'm sorry, did I completely interrupt you?
I was going to say that's not the strongest criticism of media ecology, though. You want to hear the strongest criticism? Which
I do. I really do, because I want to get to the heart of whether this
which is technological determinism. This argument that media ecology is result of this deterministic approach. That doesn't really hold up.
By deterministic, do you mean from the fact that you can observe sort of predictable patterns, like, you know, when society develops an alphabet that puts your society on a trajectory that is sort of not predetermined in a deep metaphysical sense, but you're on a certain development trajectory because of these early developments in society? Is that what you mean by determinism? I want to make sure I'm understanding exactly what you mean.
Yeah, yeah. The idea that the technology is what controls society or what affects society.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a lot of philosophers and there's a lot of anthropologists that don't like that idea.
Well, I guess there one issue that comes to mind is whether
I was going to say you're going to get a pretty good argument from an anthropologist on that. I think.
Is it just a question of emphasis? Because I could see there being a spectrum of people who think that technology or media are a dominant factor for the evolution of society versus it being one ingredient of a very complex soup, you know, where it's a factor, but it's a less significant or less dominant factor.
Yeah, exactly. I think that it's very hard to deny that media ecology does not have some kind of effect, and that where the arguments fall as they fall on how much of an effect, how strong of an effect. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of factors shaping the course of human society. I find that media ecology is a fascinating way, because I work in media, that to me, it's a fascinating way to look at the society around me and how what I do, what I'm involved in, may be affecting the world around me. If you look at the kind of change that societies with primary orality went through when they became societies that used the alphabet, and then you apply that to us, and you think, well, how did our society change when we went from the newspaper in the 19th century as the dominant form of media to the television 100 years later as the dominant?
Well, we have Star Trek
form
now.
Of television. Well, not only do we have Star Trek, but do you want to think, what was going? Were we more intellectually inclined in the 19th century? Was political discussion more about ideas and reasoned arguments? Is our communication now suffered because it's more emotional? That, you know, you want to be asking these kinds of questions. That's what media ecologists do. They ask these kinds of questions to try to understand what our media is doing to our society.
Well, it's fascinating. We're having this conversation in an election year, which I find particularly interesting, because there's a parallel concern or a discussion about what's going on in American politics that is sort of mirroring the discussion that we Star Trek fans are having about the new Star Trek movie and the new Star Trek TV series that are coming, right?
Sure.
One concern that we have is that, you know, it seems like in politics the rhetoric has become faster, more emotionally charged, less slow and thoughtful, more shooting from the hip, critical. You know, I don't want to turn this into a discussion about politics, but there's a change.
Sure.
You know, the types of things you're seeing in the debates, for example, are different than the kinds of things you would have seen in a debate 30 years ago, or different than you would have seen in a non-televised debate 100 years ago, right? And there's a change, and I think it's an uncomfortable change, because we get nostalgic for the way things used to be, you know, and we tend to sort of look at politicians and go, why can't they be a slower, more thoughtful thinker or orator? And we tend to, I think it's very easy to sort of criticize people for not being what we had seen from orators or politicians in the past. And it makes us uncomfortable because we don't know what's happening, right? We're smack in the middle of a change. And that seems to be true of what's happening in Star Trek as well, right? The medium has gotten faster. There's new types of storytelling that have emerged in the way television has gone in the last 10 or 15 years.
Sure, sure, absolutely.
You know, we get, you know, all of us Star Trek fans are nostalgic for everything we know and love about Star Trek. And it's the same kind of uncomfortable tension in our anticipation, yet maybe just a little bit of fear about what the new Star Trek stories are going to be like. It seems really similar to the types of fear you get about what's going on in politics. And I'm just making this connection now, but it seems like when you look at this through the lens of changing media, that's an interesting way to analyze this change that's going on and the sort of emotional response we have as consumers of both of those types of media, this political discourse and this entertainment medium we know and love as Star Trek.
When you talk about the upcoming Star Trek series, the upcoming movie, whatever conversation you want to jump into regarding Star Trek, I think it's a good point, Zachary, and I think you hit the nail on the head. You know, the expectation that the new Star Trek's going to be anything like the old Star Trek, I think honestly is a pipe dream at this point, because we've changed the way we tell stories, the way we consume stories. So, you know, to say that this is going to be your father's Star Trek, I don't think it's going to be, simply because we've changed in the way we tell and consume stories.
I think you're absolutely right. You want to talk a little bit about what media ecology might say about the Society of the Federation?
Sure. And, you know, I'll just preface that to, by saying that, Zachary, you mentioned Blink of an Eye, Voyager Season 6.
Thank you, Blink of an Eye. I'm so bad at titles. Blink of an Eye, that's the one I couldn't think of.
Blink of an Eye, yes. Thank you. Voyager Season 6. And we kind of got off on the tangent into anthropology there a little bit. But it seems like, for the most part, at least in the Star Trek universe, there's an expectation that a civilization will evolve in a certain way. You know, certainly they were predicting the way that culture was going to evolve simply by drawing on the history of our own. Who Watches the Watchers is another episode that comes to mind from Star Trek The Next Generation, Season 3, I think, the fourth show of that season. And so, again, you have this, proto-Vulcan kind of society that we're expecting to evolve in a certain trajectory. So it seems to me, Dennis, that plays into quite a bit this, this debate of media ecology.
Sure. Going back to the political thing that Zach was talking about, there is one thing I did want to say, that when the predominant medium that society uses changes, it's going to bring changes that are both good and bad. So if perhaps we think of this change to the very fast medium of the internet has brought some bad changes with it, like it encourages division, fragmentation, that kind of thing, perhaps it's also brought some good things with it. If it's more emotionally charged, does that perhaps help explain why in the past few decades we've seen so much more openness in our society? Even though we have a long way to go, we have made some strides in racism. We've made some strides in equality, both for genders and for sexual preferences. And those things were kind of so solidly entrenched in society for so long, and they've only recently kind of like loosened up and changed. Can we look to our more emotional, faster mediums to help explain why that's occurred now?
I guess this gets to the heart of my earlier question about whether media ecology is descriptive or normative, right? Because I think implicit in what you had to say is that there are some ethical judgments that are made. You know, there are some downsides, right? There are certain types of media or media usage that that are fragmenting or that are biased or that are prejudicial in one way or another, right? And those aren't good things. I think all of us, especially the three of us, especially Star Trek fans, probably look at that and go, those probably aren't good things. As much as relativistic and as open to other cultures as we'd like to be, in this sort of pluralistic society that is largely a tolerant one that we see in Star Trek, there are some value judgments, like those are bad things, right? And then with any new medium, there's the potential for unification, or there's the potential for creativity, there's the potential to bring people together, there's the potential to overcome those earlier struggles that society has had. And so to what extent does media ecology tend to remain sort of purely descriptive, trying to give an historical account, versus embracing those ethical judgments and saying, look, we should promote certain uses or disuses of media that steer society in a direction that is a value-laden direction, in a direction we want society to go in?
Well, it is, in its purest form, it is descriptive. It does not make a judgment on the quality of the change. It only says that there will be a change, and it tries to predict the kinds of changes that will occur without drawing a judgment on them. Mm-hmm. And then it's up to us, once we've made those predictions or once we understand the changes that are occurring, it's up to us to try to make judgments as to, do we like that? Is it good? Should we try to change it or fix it? We have to kind of understand what it is first, what's causing these things before mm-hmm. we can make any kind of attempt to change them if we don't like them.
And it seems that insofar as media ecology is under a broader umbrella of sociology. I mean, the way you first characterized media ecology is that it's a tool used by sociologists.
Sure.
You see this tension in any sociological account. You know, on the one hand, you want to expose certain causal relationships that maybe haven't been paid attention to, or you can learn something about the relationship between media and a society. Any sort of sociology is going to try to uncover those hidden causal relationships that are there that people aren't paying attention to. But only then, can you step back and say, okay, now what do we do with it? How do we solve society's problems? How do we turn that into a practical tool that we can use to build a better society? And then people are going to disagree about what type of society is the better society.
Right.
But that's a later thing that comes after the sort of purely descriptive uncovering of these factual causal relationships.
Yeah, exactly.
So I want to think now about the relationship between media ecology and Star Trek. And we started delving into this a little bit, but it strikes me that we can do this in one of two ways, and maybe both. And Dennis, since you're the guest here, I want to let you kind of be the driving factor. One direction I think we could go is to talk about media ecology as it relates to the television medium and the rise of this franchise that we know and love, its evolution and its place in the media ecological history of humankind and what it means for us going forward. Looking at Star Trek from outside, right? How do we make sense of this franchise that we care about? Another way is to talk about media ecology inside the Star Trek universe. What are the kinds of media that you see inside Star Trek? Whether it's holo novels or the news reporters that you see on the bridge of the Enterprise in Star Trek Generations. What are the different types of media that you see inside Star Trek? What are the ways that media are consumed? What are the ways those media are produced? And what can we learn about, the people and societies inside Star Trek itself? Any directions about which way is the most productive way to go, Dennis?
I think the latter is more fun, don't you?
I do think so. we live in the real world, right? So I'm interested in what Star Trek means to the world, because I think Star Trek has an effect on the world proper, right? It's become something of a motivating ideal for all of us. It's created a vision of the kind of world we would like to create.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all know that. We kind of take it for granted. I'm not sure we can learn as much there, but I think we can uncover some really interesting things about media inside Star Trek that we haven't thought about before.
Yeah, let's do that, because there's something interesting that I want to look at.
By all means.
I've always been fascinated by this idea of the holodeck, right? Because the holodeck allows you to directly experience an event. And I remember my very first class, media ecology, with my professor Casey Lum at NYU. And he kind of went through this whole thing when he was explaining what media ecology was by saying, imagine someone commit suicide by jumping off a roof. Sadly, there had been some suicides in NYU at the time, in that era. And so this was something that was on people's minds. So imagine you're walking down the street in Greenwich Village and someone jumps off a roof and kills themselves right in front of you. How do you react? How do you feel? What effect does that have on you? You've had a direct experience with that event. Now imagine you read about that event in a newspaper. Now, how does that affect you? Right? What do you learn something differently? You learn something different from reading about it in the newspaper or hearing about it on the radio or seeing it on TV. All of those different mediums bring you a different piece of the puzzle. You feel differently about the event. And the direct experience is probably the strongest impact is the direct experience. And through the holodeck, everyone can have the direct experience. You don't have to be at random chance walking down the street at that time. You can have the direct experience of any event that happened in history in the holodeck.
I see where you're going with this. And again, I have to kind of jump in as the philosopher and ask the really critical question, because I think there's a smoke and mirror trick that's going on there that bothers me a little bit. I see where you're going. You want to say the medium is different than the message, right? See what media ecology would have to say about this, right? The more visceral experience of someone of experiencing the death in front of you is different than reading about it in a newspaper. And I understand that. There's a qualitative difference there, a difference of degree, any number of things you could spell out. But I think the critical question is that really the case? I mean, it seems like you know, if something happens right in front of you, you're getting sensory information that wasn't there in the other scenario. If you just read about something, you're not getting that rich swath of sensory information. You're not seeing the blood, right? You know, but this is while that's a visceral kind of emotional experience, there's a lot of sort of extra propositional content that comes along with that, right? Oh, blood got spattered here. Oh, the person, you know, hit the ground really hard. You know, all these things that you can, that may not appear in a newspaper description of the event, you know, that it seems like there's just pure extra information you're getting from your senses there. The emotional effect aside, it seems like there's just more information when you experience something visually. Is it the medium that's doing the difference there, or is it the extra volume of this close sensory information, or am I saying the same thing you are?
They're one and the same. Every medium has that. Mm-hmm. Think about television. Television, you have visuals, but you can also have printed words on the bottom of the screen. You have music. You can have sound, right? In radio, you can have the radio announcer could be right there. A radio broadcast, man's on the edge of a roof, and then he jumps and right there in the live radio broadcast, and you hear everything. That's a certain amount of sensory input. Then you see that. Now imagine it's a camera crew. Right, man's at the edge of the roof, and then he jumps on the news live news report. Now you see it, and you hear it, and there might even be a little scrolling text below that gives his name and all that.
You're saying all the propositional content, right, is being expressed in some.
So yeah. That's all part of the medium, right? So here we have a medium in the holodeck that is so rich that it's basically come full circle, and it's like. You're back right. to being there.
But like any other media, the criticism that I have of the holodeck is like any media, it's biased. It really is, because that holodeck recreation, and it typically has to be a recreation, right? It's created from the point of view of somebody, so you don't really have an unbiased experience. You're seeing it from a particular point of view.
That's an excellent point, because even though it seems like the direct experience, it is in fact mediated.
Yes.
So what effect does that have when you go in? This is something that took people a long time to learn about photographs. They look at a photograph and they think they were seeing the real world, not knowing that no, they're not seeing anything even close to the real world, right?
Yeah. So it can be staged or biased, or
yeah,
whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah,
absolutely. Just the way it was framed. You don't have to do anything, any kind of manipulation to the photograph. You just kind of like move your camera a little bit to crop people out of the picture.
It's funny you say that, Dennis, because I have a very rich collection of family photographs, thousands of photographs from the 1850s onwards. My family's always been really, really interested in photography. I have this one photograph in particular that is of my grandfather with what I thought was just sort of a hiking group. You know, they're in the mountains, and turns out this is a totally fake picture. There's a set, and it looks very convincing and very real, but these are people dressed. No, he was a hiker, and it was a very natural mistake to make. He was, you know, was a mountaineer in a way, but this particular photograph happened to be an illusion. You know, it was in front of a set. People were dressed up in costumes. It looked very convincing, but it's all an illusion. I totally mistook the picture for reality.
That happened a lot. It happened a lot unintentionally in the early days of mm-hmm. photography, and it happens all the time completely intentionally today. But going back to the world of Star Trek, if in the environment of the Federation, most people consume their media by going a holonovel, by say experiencing a holonovel, mm-hmm. or getting their news by going into a holo broadcast of a news event. How, if they were constantly mistaking that for the real thing, how is that going to shape their, are they going to be easier to manipulate by the political structure? Because they're constantly thinking that what they're seeing in the holodeck is like the real world, or is like the real event, when really it could be completely manipulated.
Well, I have an interesting perspective on that, because you know, when we talk about holonovels, okay, the first episode that comes to mind for me is Elementary Dear Data, and I am a lover of Arthur Conan Doyle and certainly the Sherlock Holmes novels. And what Data and Geordi are experiencing on the holodeck is nothing. It is a bad recreation of a 1950s movie based on Sherlock Holmes or Arthur Conan Doyle. You know, if you read Arthur Conan Doyle, if you read Sherlock Holmes, they're very gritty. They're very gritty really is the best word I can come up with. They're very gritty stories. And Holmes was not a gentleman. He was a madman. And, you know, London in Victorian London was not a pretty place. It was a hellhole. And so Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes novels are about a madman solving crimes in a hellhole. And so, you know, the Sherlock Holmes that Data and Geordi are experiencing is nothing like the real novels that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle wrote.
Sure. What if they thought it was?
Yeah, and I think they do.
Well, we don't know though, right? I mean, you know, they're very consciously they're not recreating something in the past. It's a holo novel, right?
Sure,
when I read a novel, I give the author a lot of license to create his own interpretation of whatever world that he or she is creating, and that doesn't concern me because it's the author's creation, and I know that. I mean, are we being a little uncharitable to Data and Geordi inside the holo novel?
Well, Data does have some problems when creating holodeck characters. I mean, after all, he creates Commander Riker in Unification Part 2 and didn't quite get the hair right. So we know that he has some issues when he's creating holodeck fantasies, but we won't hold that against him.
Well, to be true media ecologists, you want to look at it from a point of view of the entire Federation society. How not just two guys using the holodeck, but how, if everyone uses the holodeck to consume their novels or their news, how is that going to change their thinking?
Yeah, you can't just focus on two guys because otherwise you start, you know, thinking all of Starfleet is running wild on Captain Proton holo novels on Voyager, right? This isn't Tom Paris and Harry Kim, right? Those are not necessarily indicative of the Federation as a whole.
But you know, I think we can actually go back. We were talking in the Turbolift before the show, and it's an upcoming episode in our From There to Here, the Menagerie. And you know, the thing I find interesting about about Menagerie, of course, you've got to go back to the 1960s. And so what we're seeing in this episode, and we won't get into the fact that they're using footage from the original pilot or anything like that, but what we're getting at in the episode, you know, we are attending a hearing and we are seeing events as they happened in in Spock's past. And you know, the thing I love about this, I think what we have here is a really good example of 23rd century dash cam, you know, in the 1960s. I mean, how genius is that? Before anybody thought about dash cam or wearing, you know, for instance, our law enforcement officers have to wear, you know, a camera on their person now. And so somebody there effectively was wearing a camera at all times to collect this footage. But, you know, here we are, you know, a generation before anyone even thought of dash cam. We've got our 23rd century dash cam in Menagerie. And then we kind of take that forward to, the Next Generation era. And I know I'm going to open a can of worms for our listeners, but, you know, that episode that shall not be named at the end of the run of Enterprise. And so effectively what we have is a historical recreation in a holodeck that Deanna suggested to Will in order to shake his conscience a little bit during the Pegasus events. And so, of course, thankfully, the good that men do fixed that whole debacle. But anyway, I digress. So we have a holographic recreation of historical events. I think it's interesting that we see this progression in Star Trek II, that they are effectively going from the dash cam of the TOS era to Next Generation era, and now we have holographic recreations of these events. I find that very fascinating. I think it's relevant for our discussion.
Sure. And what I find most interesting to me about that is that when Deanna suggests it, Riker doesn't say, "What? That's a crazy idea," or "I've never thought about that." He's just like, "Oh, okay, good idea." And like, it's a normal
thing. Yeah.
So that seems to say to me that it's kind of a normal thing to call up if you're curious about something or you want to learn about something you're thinking about, you're making a decision to call up something in the holodeck and kind of work through it or live through it. And so that seems to mean to me that the holodeck is their predominant media in that society. And so that just starts my mind running in all these different ways.
Well, I can think of other examples. I'm thinking of that episode of Voyager. And again, I'm terrible at remembering the episode names. One of you can help me out with a name. The episode of Voyager where there was a parallel evolution of dinosaurs that turned into a sentient bipedal species that left Earth. And now they've
that was a good episode.
That was a great episode. What's the name of that episode?
Oh,
I just thought of it right now. And I can't think of the name. Anyways, it doesn't matter. But, you know, Captain Janeway, when they're first trying to understand what's going on, you know, Captain Janeway says, "Let's go to the holodeck," right? Let's have the computer project what the future evolution of dinosaurs might be had they not gone extinct. And, you know, going to the holodeck is the way to do that. And I think as I think through this, Dennis, I think part of my trouble in knowing what to talk about when we're talking about media ecology in Star Trek is there's so many different kinds of examples of media inside Star Trek, and they all so and at the same time Star Trek doesn't quite give you enough to go on, right? We know that there are holo novels. We know that the holodeck is used in legal proceedings, right? You see charges being brought against Riker and the situations being reenacted on the holodeck. You see holodeck as a type of a fictional medium. You see a holodeck as a historical medium, right? And at the same time, there are some things that are wonderfully anachronistic, right? Captain Picard still reads books. You can see Jake Sisko, you know, he's a reporter. He's writing with a stylus on a pad, right? and so there are these... it's not the only medium. You know, older media haven't necessarily gone away. And I think it's plausible to say that the holo medium has become the dominant medium. It's used for all kinds of things. We see characters doing other things, too. They don't just listen to music on the holodeck. There are string quartets on the Enterprise-D, for example. And that's all the only kind of music they listen to on the Enterprise-D. No matter what kind of technological progress and different kinds of media have emerged in Star Trek The Next Generation, on the Enterprise-D, they only listen to string quartets.
I thought that was because they all have very good taste. But it might have something more to do with.
I'm sure it could be a woodwind quartet. I guess they have a clarinet.
And they put on plays. That's one of the things. And you mentioned it's Distant Origin.
Distant Origin.
Distonomy, the name of the Voyager episode. Yeah, using the holodeck to extrapolate what the evolution of a species might be. You know, one of the things that. I, again, with my initial background being in newspaper, I look for media in the Star Trek universe, and you know, surprisingly, Zachary, you mentioned at the top of the show the coverage of the Enterprise B launch in Generations being an example of the news media being there covering an event. We see that again in the episode season 4 of Enterprise Demons, I believe it was. And interestingly enough, her name was Gannett Brooks. Gannett being the largest newspaper company in America. I thought that was fascinating. Hmm. But, you know, there's the media coverage. And the thing that I find interesting about that is, and understand this was over 10 years ago at this point, is the fact that they were recording news. Are you ready for this? Point of view. If you recall, no one was really holding a camera. They were mounted to their head. It was all point of view. So I think it's interesting that, you know, not only is can Star Trek be credited for the invention of the iPad, but really 10 years before anyone really thought about point of view photography or point of view news media, you know, there they are depicting it in the Star Trek universe. And of course, Jake Sisko in Deep Space Nine, Time to Stand in particular, comes to mind when we really see him, you know, acting as a correspondent recording the events of the war there and how it affects, you know, Deep Space Nine. So, again, seeing this kind of played out in the Star Trek universe and really seeing a variety there. Jake Sisko is in essence, a newspaper reporter. Then we have, you know, point of view media in Demons. We, you know, we see holodeck being used to recreate historical events. I find that really refreshing because at least what that says to me is that whether it be a hot media or a cool media, you know, there's, as you mentioned, Dennis, earlier, there's a cycle here, and I see a place for that now for each type of media. I've got bookshelves full of books back here. I enjoy watching television. I enjoy going to theater. I enjoy live music. I enjoy listening to recorded music. I take my news on television and newspapers and online. So at least for me, I like my media in all forms, and it really depends on, you know, how I'm feeling on a particular day and what I'm in the mood for, and that's going to be how I take my media.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. Of course, we never did get to see any of the raw footage from these cameras. They could have,
and no one thought to turn the camera around and take a selfie. The art of the selfie had died out by the time the 23rd and 24th centuries rolled around. Point of view footage aside,
I have a kind of a theory on that, and that is that some of these cameras may have been holorecorders, because you talk about, I think, didn't Data have like a holo camera, or the Doctor or somebody?
The doctor, who was always asking people to snap holo photos for him. Yeah.
The Doctor.
Get a holo image for me.
Where they were running around with the, I have to bring my holo camera. And so perhaps all these reporters are actually taking, they look like they're taking point of view or first person, but perhaps they're just setting themselves as the center of a holographic sphere or a holographic cube, then that's how the camera is recorded.
Which goes back to my original point about even that holodeck recreation is something that's created from a point of view or from a, for lack of a better way of putting it, a skewed point of view.
Sure, absolutely.
So, Dennis, let me ask you this very media ecology-inspired question. So, assuming that the hologram... Again, I'm not convinced because we don't... I think Star Trek doesn't quite give us enough information to know for sure that that holography is the dominant medium. It's a good hypothesis. Okay. I don't think we have enough information to know that for sure. But assuming that we're true, what can we learn from that? You know, what effect does that have on the Federation society as a whole? What effect does that have on the way that Starfleet officers think? You know, can we draw any conclusions inspired by media ecology about Star Trek from that hypothesis?
That's hard to answer because we don't have really much experience with using holograms, right? We see them used in Star Trek, but we don't experience we don't experience what it's like to be walking around inside a recreation of something, right? Which is, that's what they're doing, is they go in, and for the time that the hologram is running, they are experiencing firsthand the event. They could turn around, you know, they look forward, they see the front of the room, they turn around, they see the back of the room. They're not looking at a little plane of glass the way we're used to looking at it. So how is that shape one's thinking? All I can do is say, well, what would it be like if every time you consumed media, it was like being there?
I'm going to use a Star Trek example to kind of ask the question another way. When the Doctor in Voyager writes the holo novel, or creates the holo novel, Photons Be Free, right? He forces the other crew members who are participating firsthand in this holo novel to wear this backpack that has a weight on their shoulders that's symbolic of the mobile emitter that he has to carry around. He wants them to feel the weight of being different from everyone else and whatnot. And he uses that to inspire, I would say eventually, if you talk about that episode and maybe the episode following that, the Doctor uses that as a way of dealing with the issue of holographic rights, right? So it's not just, it's not purely a fictional story. It's not purely an emotional immersive environment, and certainly the holodeck would be more immersive. That's unquestionable. But what effect does it have? That inspires his crewmates to take up this cause of holographic rights when the question of the doctor's ownership of his own intellectual property comes into question, right? You know, does he really own the product of his own work or not? And that inspires this very interesting discussion towards the end of Voyager about holographic rights. And that's a real issue. This is a new kind of being that's sentient. This is a question of rights. These are, you know, important, deep, fundamental issues for any society. And it all started with the Doctor's holographic novel.
Something that Zachary reminded me while he was giving his example was that the holographic novel or a holographic news broadcast requires participation on the part of the audience. And as instructors, anyone who's taught a class can tell you, you learn better by participating. So it would seem to me that a society that either relied on holographic experience, holographic recreation to learn things and to experience things would probably learn those things faster mm-hmm. and more with more depth and more retention. So it might have a very, from our perspective, a very positive impact on their society.
This must be why they're teaching calculus to 8-year-olds on the Enterprise D, right? There's some immersive holographic calculus teaching environment.
That's pretty much all I can come up with about holograms.
Well, I think the thing that's hard, Dennis, is just that there's so many things we could talk about, and we only have an hour or so, hour and a half here in the podcast to talk about everything. I would love to talk in more detail about the relationship between media as a tool for changing society. That seems to be what's going on in that example with the Doctor, right? The holographic novel becomes a tool that inspires this change in the Federation society to take up this issue of holographic rights. And certainly, I think that the fact that media is a tool that can be used to change society, that's not a new idea to us now. I think at a certain point, that was probably a new idea, though, right? I mean, the idea that you can use the medium. It's not that the medium transcends the message, because the message is still important, right? It's
exactly. You know,
I think this is the part, the philosopher in me is bothered by this a little bit. The idea that you could ignore the propositional content for the sake of the media, that would be taking this a little too far, I think. I don't think anyone would, I don't think any media ecologist would probably advocate for doing that either.
No.
We had to learn at a certain point that it's not purely the propositional content that's being conveyed. There's all this subconscious information processing aspect of media consumption, media experience that transcends the propositional content. And it's at least more content or it's a different kind of content or it has different kind of effects than the propositional content. And all of that is really interesting. I would love to flesh out all these different examples that we get inside Star Trek. Every kind of media that we see, whether they're holographic news recorders or holo novels or even something really, really wacky, you know, whether it's, you know, like acting out the promotion ceremony on the holodeck when Worf gets promoted in Star Trek Generations.
Right.
Pick your favorite example of media in Star Trek. And, you know, we could come up with 100 different kinds of examples. And I think we would tell an interesting, different story about all 100 of those. I'm thinking, Dennis, that you need to create your own Trek FM podcast about media ecology, where the goal is to find as many different kinds of media in Star Trek as you can and give a fully comprehensive media ecology narrative about each of those examples. I couldn't do that, I don't think. I know you could do it.
I'll keep that in mind, Zachary.
You can run that by Chris Jones.
Yeah. So Zachary, are those your final thoughts?
I think it is. I think when I first was thinking about media ecology, I think my concern was that it's always been my concern from a philosophical perspective. Like, it's interesting to learn about the history of thought. It's interesting to learn about the history of media. It's interesting to learn about the causal relationship between the two. But when it comes to what conclusions we draw from that, I'm looking for something kind of philosophically substantive. And, you know, what can we learn about ethics? What can we learn about politics? What can we learn about the normative aspect, the way society should be? And it seems like media ecology leaves me a little bit hanging there. You know, it errs on the descriptive side. And that's good because it's a science in that sense, right? It's an historical sociological science. It's not its job to be necessarily normative. But, you know, I want to ask those ethical questions from a philosophical standpoint, and I'm not sure that media ecology alone can answer those questions. I can make interesting connections to other areas in the history of philosophy that we didn't talk about. I think in my mind, it's from what I heard from Dennis about media ecology is related to things like Friedrich Nietzsche trying to give a historical, what he called a genealogy of the history of ethics, right? In fact, one of his books is called The Genealogy of Morals, and sort of this anthropological, sociological story of media. It was very similar to something that Nietzsche might try to do with these ethical concepts, right and wrong, and in some sort of moral sense. So that's an interesting connection in my mind. It also strikes me as related to this broadly postmodern movement. I'm thinking of things like Jean Baudrillard and his account of the relationship between the way in which simulation affects society, right? You know, we don't just need to experience reality directly. We can simulate it, right? So in Star Trek land, I'm thinking of, like, why do you even need to jump on a starship and go exploring? Can't you just do all your exploring in the holodeck? Wouldn't that be just as good, right? Why not, if the holodecks are that good? And you start to lose your ability to distinguish between what you're learning from reality proper and what you're learning from simulation. So, and that if you really want to hold on to that distinction line between reality and everything fictional or everything merely a simulation, that distinction starts to break down. And what does that mean for us? I think that's true more now than it was even 20 years ago. What does it mean in Star Trek society? I have no idea. We'd have to kind of flesh it out. I just wish we had more time to talk about particular examples. You know, I really want to geek out and talk about 100 different kinds of examples about media ecology now and media in Star Trek, and we don't have the time to do that tonight. Mm-hmm. But these are all things I hadn't thought about until recently, and they're fun to think about. I think we can learn a lot from them. I think we can learn a lot about what Star Trek means to society as a whole if we try to look at Star Trek from outside of Star Trek from a media ecology perspective. And, of course, we can geek out and talk about examples inside Star Trek probably until the proverbial cows come home, or until the Enterprise comes home. Those are my final thoughts.
So, Dennis, it was great to have you here on the show and to give us your perspective on media ecology. Is there anything you want to share as a final thought?
No, I think you guys have pretty much covered everything. Everything that we can get into today, we'll say that.
Before we let you go, why don't you let our listeners know where else they can find you on the Trek FM network? And if there's anything you'd like to tell listeners about your current projects for the network or outside the network, this would be a great chance.
Well, you can find me as the host of Continuing Mission. I'm also always on the Babel Conference. You can always reach me there. And I have a Twitter handle, which is simply @DennisCastello.
All right. Well, by way of my final thoughts, I just, Zachary, like you, there's 100 different directions I could have gone with this, and I almost went there, but thank you, Dennis, for wrangling me back into the conversation. It wasn't that I conflated the topics. I had a different direction I was sort of going when we were talking about art imitating life and life imitating art, and I can pull up 100 different examples and you know, go in 100 different directions talking about how this relates to the Star Trek universe. In fact, one of the things I kind of had jotted down here as we were talking, I was jotting down some notes, and I wanted to kind of go off and talk a little bit about, for instance, in Time's Arrow, how the future events, the Enterprise and Jean-Luc Picard and Data, that certainly had influence on the likes of Mark Twain, or as he was known as Samuel Clemens and Jack London, and how, at least perceived in the Star Trek universe, how they shaped the media of at least in that case the early 1900s. But that's a discussion for another day. I found this really fascinating, and I learned a few things today, which is always great. I find it fascinating the way media can shape a society. And so just in terms of my final thoughts, I think, as I said before, I take my media in all forms, and I think, at least if I have an optimistic view of the future, it is that, media will continue to be available to the human creature in all forms, and evolve in ways, I think, that are constructive and really add to the rich texture of the ways that we consume our media.
Well, Dennis, I'm just glad that we could have you on the show tonight. Like I said at the beginning of the show, you're with us every single time we sit down to record MetaTrek. I'm glad we finally had a reason to get you on the show behind the microphone, and I'm looking forward to having you on again soon. We'll look for another reason to bring you on the show very soon.
Well, thanks a lot, Zach and Mike. It's been a lot of fun coming out from the engineer's booth onto the soundstage and recording with you guys. So it's been a lot of fun for me, and something that I've been always wanting to do.
Well, while we still have you, Dennis, I should let the listeners know that every single time we record an episode, Dennis sends me an email disagreeing with everything we had to say, and he's been chomping at the bit for 16 weeks now to chime in and get on the mic and join the conversation. So by all means, I'm glad we could have you on the show. And podcasting is addicting. I think, you know, I had this experience. You probably had this experience where, you know, you listen to people talking about Star Trek, this thing you love, you've got your own ideas, and you start to get this vision that I want to do this. I know I could do this. And it's great to finally, you know, have you behind the microphone. And once you start doing it, you won't get enough of it. So
thanks for the opportunity. I hope that it was interesting for the usual Metatrex listener.
Absolutely. I learned a lot tonight. All right, we'll let you go. Thanks, Dennis.
Thanks. Goodbye.
Well, Mike, that was great to have Dennis on the show tonight. Like I said beforehand, Dennis is with us each and every week, and it's great to finally get him on the show and get him behind the mic. And, you know, I sort of worry that sometimes it's just you and me as two talking heads. You know, we've got our own perspectives, we've got our own opinions, we've got our own ways of breaking things apart. And it just reminds me that we have a community on Trek FM of people who are smart, intelligent, they've got their own ideas, and all of us have our own expertise. We can all learn from each other. And this very sort of intercollegiate, collegial, friendly, mutually respectful environment that we've created here on Trek FM is wonderful. It means any conversation we have here on Metatrex could be much more interdisciplinary and more communal and more collaborative than we tend to let it be with just the two of us.
Oh, absolutely. I said it before and I'll say it again. You know, we're just extremely privileged to have Dennis behind the scenes. And to bring him on the podcast, bring him on the ship, and put him in the captain's chair for this episode, as it were. It was a lot of fun. It was a great discussion. I learned a ton, and I found the whole conversation very fascinating. It's been a lot of fun talking about media ecology in the Star Trek universe and how it relates. But this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week, so here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Earl Grey.
Geordi is the one that's like, you know what? No, you're wrong. You're wrong about Data.
I'm going to drop a challenge right here, and Data's totally going to step up to the plate, and you're going to get served, Plasky.
And that's how LaForge created Moriarty.
I'm not saying it turned out good, but I mean, he had good intentions.
The Orb.
The Wadi, a fun-loving race from the Gamma Quadrant, arrive at DS9 eager to play a game with Sisko and the crew, one that appears to be a matter of life and death. All right, so are we moving along, Matthew?
Oh, we're moving along.
Is there any redeeming value?
The Ready Room.
He's carrying in the lamb chop sock puppet, saying, "She stayed at her post."
While Charlie Horse ran.
While Charlie Horse ran.
To the journey!
She has a holographic boyfriend that malfunctions. That can mean only one thing. She knows how he malfunctions.
Well, I hear it's common in a lot of guys his age. Commentary, Trek Stars.
I haven't seen Mean Girls.
You haven't seen Mean Girls.
I know. Everybody wants me to see Mean Girls.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you have to see Mean Girls. I mean, after Josie and the Pussycats, though.
Oh, how could I forget Josie and the Pussycats?
The 602 Club.
I actually like when they bring in the big container for the brain fish at the beginning.
That's so weird.
And yeah, it opens up and it's, you know, speaking through the...
And all the minions that have to mop up after it at the end.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty funny.
Although it's like a slug trail.
You can actually see one of the guys while he's talking kind of wandering around mopping up. I was like, what is that guy doing?
Literary Treks.
You're totally right that when Atonement was done, I really did feel like everybody needed a break.
Like a Kit Kat bar?
There wouldn't be challenges and obstacles and things, but I wanted the next sort of series of adventures that they faced for a while to be more infused with the sense of wonder that sort of underpins all of Trek.
Women at Warp.
You can always count on DC Fontana to Vulcan things up, and I for one appreciate her for that.
Get Vulcan with it. Na 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 na. Na 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 na. Get Vulcan with it.
Meta Treks.
Don't tell me you haven't wondered what it's like to be Patrick Stewart.
Actually, I've wondered. I've often wondered what it's like to be the Shat.
There's no way to know. It's one of a kind.
He's one of a kind. He's one of a kind.
Melodic Treks.
But it's basically from a motivation of not treating the audience stupid. You know, treating them that they have dreams, they have imagination, they have hope, they have fear. They have all those things, and the music plays on that.
And introducing Saturday Morning Trek, a show about the animated series and all things Trek in the 1970s.
Like, 6 episodes counts as a season? This isn't The British, okay? This
is 2 seasons of Sherlock. Come on.
This isn't Sherlock. Yes, I've been waiting for several years to see more Star Trek, which is like Sherlock. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. But From There to Here is also a good podcast you should listen to.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly, and it makes it very easy for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, hey, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the incredible perks that we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, you can get a producer credit on our shows, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. Hey, we really appreciate any support that you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make that happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything that we've discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on our show site. That's trek.fm/contact.
If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our show page on the Trek FM website, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
Find us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @trekfm.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/trekfm, and find us in the Babel Conference. The Babel Conference is Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We'd also like to invite you to leave us a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. Perhaps maybe we'd even get around to reading your review here on the show. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for our podcast. Well, Zachary, when you're not participating in a historical recreation on the holodeck, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, you can find me on several recent episodes of The Ready Room. That's Trek FM's flagship show. You can also find me on Facebook and the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And my handle on Twitter is just my name, Zachary Fruhling, ZacharyFruhling. And how about you, Mike? Where can our listeners find you around the network and on the internet these days?
Well, Zachary, I too have made a couple visits to the Ready Room. I've also been a fairly regular guest on Warp 5, where I am an associate producer. Of course, always in the Babel Conference, if you'd like to chat about Star Trek and philosophy, you can find me there and on Facebook. And on Twitter, my handle is @cmichael1701. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM, our executive producer, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, our art director, Aaron Harvey, content manager, Will Wynn, our production manager, Richard Marquez, and our fabulous editor and producer, Dennis Costello. Thanks for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.